After Party Pod is brought to you by the book Ending Addiction for Good, which is by Cliffside Treatment Center founder and CEO Richard Tate and Dr. Constance Scharf, Cliffside's addiction researcher. Through self-disclosure, case studies, scientific facts, and firsthand experience, Tate and Scharf explain how anyone can recover from addiction. The book is great. I'm a fan of it. And I'm not the only one. It's received rave reviews, and it made it into the VMA's gift bag. And you just know those people need to hear this message. You can get the book on Amazon, of course, or by going to their website, which is cliffsidemalibu.com. You're listening to House Calls with Laura House.
House Calls.
And Laura House is going to give us her reaction on the word slip.
Slip. That is a confusing term to me because, because it makes it sound so sweet. It makes it sound so, like, but that's a start over situation.
Yeah.
A slip is,
yeah,
like, that's kind of when, like, the signs are like, buzz driving is drunk driving. It's like, that is, like, it makes it sound like it's no big deal.
Yeah.
And it's not that it's a big deal, like, it's wrong or anything. It just means that it's like, it makes it sound like there's a spectrum of not being sober anymore.
Yeah.
And there's not.
It's almost pregnant.
It's, yeah, exactly. It's, yeah, real black and white. And so, but I came in through a food program.
Okay.
And they would use the term slip. And I remember a sober guy going, what do you mean slip? And it's like, well, I'm only supposed to have half a cup of oatmeal, but I had a whole cup of oatmeal. And like, I will grant you that slip.
Right.
Okay, you had a cup of oatmeal. You weigh and measure all your food. You had an extra spoonful or whatever. Like that, okay, that's a slip. But like, yeah, in boot, because he explained it. He was like, because with alcohol, there's no.
Yeah. Well, but I think.
I just had a little bit of alcohol. I'm totally fine.
Yeah. I think that what it's meant to describe, and this is confusing because not everybody like knows that. It's like if you just went out briefly.
Yeah.
You know.
Which that I get too. But then that's just like a
it doesn't matter.
A quick relapse, which is good. Like.
Right.
Better than.
Not coming back.
Yeah. Better than lots of scenarios. But yeah, slip is I also, I guess I. You know, everything gets filtered through your own
experience. Well,
my own experience. And also, you're asking me to give my own response. Sorry, I think of me and, like, if I had, like, what I would think of as, like, I guess slip makes me think of sip.
Oh.
So I can see myself, like, I'm at the Hollywood Bowl. And, like, sometimes I look at my boyfriend's alcohol and I'm like, what if I just had
a little?
Or, like, if it's a fruity drink, like, somebody's having a Greyhound or something and I'm like, well, that looks refreshed. That doesn't look like something that could kill me.
Yeah,
that just looks like a completely delightful experience in that glass. And I just think, like, I could have, like, a sip of that would go, oh, that's a slip. If I ran back in the room, you know, called 10 people, ran back in the room, I would not. So to me, like, a slip is such an avalanche, you know,
I did it. Well, when I was 6.5 months sober, I went out to have a drink and I ended up having 4.5 hits of ecstasy and 2 bottles of wine.
That's what I would do.
The next day, that was considered a slip by some.
But you still start the day. What's the difference?
It's no difference.
Makes no sense.
Yeah. Should we try to eliminate it from the language?
Should we? That's a little controlling. Should we just insist no one say it anymore?
Yeah.
I think it is a little because it's. For me, like, being sober today, I go, oh, a slip doesn't sound bad at all.
Right.
But, like, when people go, oh, I relapsed, was rough, I go, oh, that's something I'd like to avoid. Like, a slip sounds something I'd like to experience. Yeah,
again, so the reason that
it's not a good word for me.
Campaign to eradicate it, and you judged me. I'm trying to help people.
We've all got to just live, and I'm saying that's a really controlling thing to go to.
You heard it from Laura. I'm controlling. This has been House Calls with Laura House. Hi, it's Anna David here with the After Party Pod. But you know that. You downloaded it. At least, I hope you downloaded it and it's not like it is being thrust upon you while you are in captivity and somebody is forcing you to listen to it. That would be a terrible circumstance. Let's assume your circumstance for listening to this is better. Many treats in store for you today. The continuation of the amazing segment, House Calls with Laura House, of course, as well as a guest named Michael DeBar, who is a truly unique man that I met a long time ago, and I don't have like an older man thing. That is not my thing, but I was so attracted to him. I was so drawn to him because he's really the single most charming human being that I had ever met. I'm trying to decide. He's really up there. And I had never met anybody like him. And we talk about this in the interview, but he was sitting at this party that I was taken to where I didn't know anybody. And he was in a black leather vest and he wasn't wearing a shirt. And that again, not exactly the kind of thing that I would necessarily be drawn to. But he commanded all this attention because he was so funny. And he has this way of sort of projecting, I don't know, I think he's a great appreciator of life. And I thought he was really uber fabulous. And I guess we sort of became friends. And then I was sort of bottoming out in my addiction. And he was sober, which I took to mean he was, you know, going to perform a citizen's arrest on me if he knew what I was up to. But he was not. He was the perfect way to be. He was the way that I hope I am when I encounter addicts or people who are using drugs, which is to say that he did not make me feel judged. He seemed mostly bewildered by why I was choosing to, ingest vats of cocaine. And then we had a little dalliance. And it was fun. It was brief. I was not sober. And then when I got sober, he was around, and he is truly an inspiring guy, and he has done many things. He is now 65. He does not look it. He has been in a billion bands. He was in the Power Station. He was in a band called Detective. He co-wrote the song, "You're My Obsession. You're My Obsession." It's like the ode to alcoholism. He wrote it about cocaine. He not only reveals that in this episode, but he also sings a bit of it. How's that for an exclusive? He has been an actor. He is an actor. He's been on a billion and one things, starting with WKRP in Cincinnati. Remember that? He was on Melrose Place. I believe he was Heather Locklear's evil boss at the advertising agency. And he has been in a lot of movies. Ugh, he was in one of the Poison Ivies. Very sexy role. He was on Nip Tuck. He has been in millions of things. He was also on Live Aid. Remember that? And a confession. I sing karaoke, not well. I think it's sad if you sing karaoke well, a little bit. So I have friends that I go and I sing karaoke with, and one of our songs that we'll sing as a group is that "We Are the World." You see why I'm not a singer. "We are the children." That didn't sound that bad. But we all like put our arms around each other and act like we're Bono and Michael DeBar. And it's fun. And anyway, Michael has been sober since 1981. And I think that has a lot to do with why he emanates this light, loving energy. And also why he doesn't look remotely near 65. So I hope you enjoy my interview with him. He's got a show called The Michael DeBar Show, which we talk about, which is apparently very popular. So if you're not listening to it, you're maybe the only one. Anyway, listen, love, comment, recommend, give stars, do whatever you want to do. I just like you for listening, and I hope you are not in captivity. I really do. Okay, here we go.
The cynicism and the irony, the need for to prove you're outside of the world and that you're a rebel, and it's nonsense.
Do you think that's what swearing does?
I think it's part of the vernacular that goes with the persona that is chosen as rebellious. Yes.
Interesting. You know, I went to a life coach when I was living in New York. Did you know I ever lived in New York?
I think I did know that you lived on the East Coast because you're so sophisticated, darling. You should absolutely live in the...
No.
In fact, for the rest of the interview, I'm going to imagine us somewhere in a penthouse off Fifth
Avenue.
At the
Algonquin table?
You're way too smart for those idiots. Dorothy Parker.
Dorothy Parker. If only
Place.
She could keep up with my witty repartee. Now you put me on the spot.
Kaufman. Well, he was the funniest of them all and the least known, you know.
I what was his first name? Because we're not talking about Andy. Okay.
Elvis.
Elvis Kaufman.
Elvis Kaufman.
I won't believe anything I'm told.
Ludwig. Ludwig Kaufmann was the... No, I can't remember his name either.
No, okay, because I would say Fitzgerald would join them at times.
No.
Yes.
He'd be too drunk by then. You know, but the thing is about that whole Algonquin thing is I think the reason we mythologize that is because there isn't those salons, you know, those
no.
You know, you'd think it would be on TV. You'd think there would be a weekly, fantastically intellectual, funny, drunken dinner party on television. You know what I mean? I mean, now it would be, but it isn't because it's drunken louts tearing each other's hair extensions out.
Alcoholism used to be appealing.
Well, it was not only appealing, it was symbolic of the age. Yeah. If you didn't have a martini in one hand and a cigarette in the other, you were an idiot and wore a vest.
Yeah.
You know, you know, it was a symbol of cool in those days. And that's, you know, that's what redefining cool has been part of my sobriety to a great deal.
Yeah,
you know
that's
what
interesting.
I mean?
That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, you know, the Jimmy Dean dangling cigarette frown, angst-ridden collar up look, to me, you know, maybe Calvin Klein is turned on by it, but not me. And, you know, it's such an old-fashioned archetype.
Well, because ultimately, to me, that spell, I mean, not to be so Susie, you know, healthy, but like, you know, it just spells like depressed, alone, angsty, withdrawn. Like, that's not even appealing to
me. But you know what's worse than that? Pretending to be angsty and withdrawn. And that's the real comedy where you get somebody who's really joyous and happy, but he figures he can't because it ain't cool.
Right.
So he gets the stubble like Johnny. Now, they all look like Johnny Depp's younger brother. And, you know, and they're all swinging on Jack Daniels, which is disgusting. And before long, they're addicted to something they don't want to be addicted to.
Well, it's interesting because you, since I've known you, obviously you've been sober, but also you have never sort of, as far as I've seen it, you know, tried to shield your sort of buoyant, joyous side. I'm wondering when you were like a very cool rocker, if you were like, no, I'm withdrawn, I'm not happy.
No, there was another persona I chose, which was abandoned and anarchism, I think, you know, like the Iggy figure, the self-mutilating figure. And I mean that metaphysically, not physically. God forbid I would ever hurt myself physically.
You love yourself too
much. I said, not a blemish, not a scar. Who is it, Michael DeBar? I would never in any way hurt that. No. But I was...
Is it hurting you that we don't have a video camera on you right now?
It hurts me that there's not a camera on me at all times.
Yeah.
Especially at Ralph's, strangely enough.
They're probably watching you.
But they, you know they are.
Yeah.
I mean, I know somebody's, some CIA, you know, Claire Danes is somewhere filming me.
Did you know I've never seen that show?
Oh.
Just watching Breaking Bad now.
Oh, God. Well, you know, it's like that phenomena, Anna, of binging.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost as if watching Breaking Bad 7 seasons in one day is the new Coke.
I know.
You can snort Walter White.
Right.
You know, for a week. I mean, and it's so interesting that our society has now gone into the media as an addiction. It's so interesting to me. Very well put by Kevin Spacey in his wonderful speech at Edinburgh Film Festival few weeks ago. I'm sure you saw it. And he broke it down.
I read the tweets about it.
Oh, it was a phenomenal.
I heard
it's only
that.
5 minutes. You can handle it.
I don't know that I have the attention span.
But it was really, really, he summed it up. You know, what is a movie? What is a series? What is it? Is it on your phone? Is a movie last 13 hours? Does it last an hour and a half? How do you see? He really just smashed the whole convention of what we do, you know, here, what we're doing here. I mean, what is this? This is a conversation, you know, and we could film it and we could put it up on YouTube and we could put it on our phones and our iPads and so on and so forth. So binging is the new drug, Binging Anonymous.
Well, but the thing is, I mean, if you compare it to other drugs, how very healthy.
Well, I mean,
or is it get out of the binge philosophy?
Well, that's it, isn't it? I think that the binge philosophy, for the most part, is escape. You know, I've got this new thing in my head, which is the notion that if you do espouse to going off the grid, I would consider that cowardice.
What do you mean? What is that, go off the grid?
We are here for each other.
Right.
If we are not here for each other right now, today, in this world that we live in, which is divided and corrupt And absolutely, the disparity is enormous and getting, you know, further and further distant as the hours go by. If you're not going to fight for it, your freedom as a human being and as an individual now, then when on earth are you going to do it? And would you make the decision to go to Oregon with your family? You know, is that what the move is, to run away from what the very time when we need community?
Right, right. Well, and you see the internet as, I mean, I just listened to the Judd Nelson episode of your show.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you spoke a lot about how you see the internet as, you know, as sort of the great divider and the great connector, which I think is well said.
Yes, it's a strange technology that is, but it's like anything. I mean, you know, in a relationship, you can abuse a relationship, you can both want each other for the worst reasons and yet be absolutely connected, or you can be there for each other in a mystical sense and in a unifying sense. It's what you perceive it to be.
Right.
It's like, if, you know, I only wear black clothes simply because I'm so narcissistic that it left to other colors, I would never leave the house. You know what I mean?
Because it simplifies the getting dressed process.
It simplifies the getting dressed process. The other day, I posted a photograph of my wardrobe, the contents of one of my wardrobes, right?
Uh-huh.
Which is all black.
Yeah.
And I put variety is the spice of life, you know, because in a way, in some high, cool way, it sort of, you know, brings it all back to, you know, one thing, and I don't have to think about that. I'll just wear black. But my point being is the internet has been an incredible tool for me because, you know, it does give you the ownership of what you do.
Right.
And that has been so important to me in my musical efforts, you know, because I've been on 1,000 labels, been in 100 bands, and, you know, had 20 record deals and 40 managers, and, you know, and none of them have really done a damn thing for me.
Right.
You know, they have got their own agenda, and right. I mean, this is nothing new to your listeners, I'm sure, but the ownership and of your own content, terribly important. Unbelievably important. That's what the internet provides.
It's interesting because my whole thing with, I've started this website and I basically hit the point where I have been successful as a writer, sort of undeniably successful.
Absolutely,
you know,
my sixth
book is coming out,
and
I am tired of making money for everybody else.
That's correct.
I can't do it anymore.
No, you mustn't. I mean, Well, it's the same thing going back to the principle of not going off the grid. You're going on your own grid.
Right.
You know, I mean, we're all on a grid. Don't kid yourself. You think because you're going to move to Oregon that Claire Danes can't see you? Come
right,
on.
Right, right, right.
You think Saul isn't going to come knocking at your door?
But I'm getting the references anyway because
these are all references of characters that, you know, are in this mythical television show, you know, observers of humanity and society. And there's no privacy. You know, who the hell wants to see pictures of your granny at Thanksgiving? Darling, I absolutely, you took the words right out of my mouth. Must have been when you were kissing me. Do you know what that is? That's a Meatloaf song.
By the way, we kissed a million years ago.
Yes, we kissed.
Is that okay to talk about?
Kisses are always good to talk about.
And, let's talk briefly about, my exposure to you, because what you do, and it's
exposure?
Very charming.
Yeah, we can talk about your exposure.
Oh, Michael, do you remember blah, blah, blah about me? You go, oh, yes, of course. And I think you're not entirely accurate.
No.
I don't know what you remember, but I'm going to tell you exactly because you
right
are
now
such a memorable figure.
Wow.
And you have and I have a good memory when it comes to memorable figures, not for anything else.
Well, you have a memorable figure.
Okay, so what happened is when I was a terrible alcoholic but not yet a drug addict, I hadn't really connected with my true love, cocaine. We had flirted, but we had not gotten into a relationship. I was taken to a party in the hills. It was a daytime party. My friend was dating some older man. That's all I remember. You were holding court in a black vest. You were wearing pants, but you had no shirt under the black vest.
Oh, dear.
And
that was my Chippendales phase.
Okay, but all I know is that I don't think, honestly, like, I had ever met a person as charming as you. I think it was like a shock to my system. Mm. And I just said, who is that man? Mm. Why is he so charming? I must know him. And we sort of talked, and I was drunk, and I don't think you remember this. This just was, like, random, and I was very, you know, impressed with your stardom and all of that stuff. Cut to, fast forward, I want to say 2 years. I went to a party at my ex-boyfriend from college, who I randomly just spoke to yesterday. He's now a therapist at a treatment center. He and I were both like deep into our addiction. He had a party It is in Beechwood. You were there. I can even tell you a girl named Catherine took you, an actress that you were friends with.
Yes, Catherine Butler. Great photographer, actress.
I don't think
I
that
remember
was...
remember it.
I don't know if the...
Blonde.
First of all, I don't think that was... Her name was Catherine Butler, but I...
Catherine Kendall.
That might have been it.
Yeah, she changes her name every now and then. The CIA are after her. No, but I remember distinctly this whole Beechwood blonde photographer, actress, you, absolutely.
I don't even believe you, but I'm flattered that you're playing along.
Julie, if I've ever told the truth, it's...
So here's what I remember, that I got to this party, yeah. And I very quickly learned that that I didn't have cocaine. I thought, maybe I ran out of cocaine. I called my dealer, and I remember getting my dealer to come to this party, and that was when cocaine was still fun. It wasn't terrible. I was still doing it with people, and I remember... You also made an impression on me at that daytime party because you were sober. And I was like, but only freaks and terrible people are sober. So you made this, I was like, you can be fabulous and sober? What? And so I said to you at this party, I think we were flirting sort of, and I said, sure. I have to run outside because my coke dealer is here. To go get my cocaine and pay him.
What did I say?
And what you said was, and I appreciated this so much because you know when you're a drug addict and you are talking to a sober person, you think that sober person is a cop, basically.
Yeah,
you
or going to judge you.
They think that person is either going to arrest you or judge you, and you're not sure which is worse.
Right.
Worse.
Right.
So you said, "Darling, why are you doing cocaine? That's so 80s." But it's stuck in my mind. And then I think we went on a date.
Yes, we did.
Yes.
Yes, we did.
And it was lovely.
Yeah.
Maybe we went
on
a date.
Well, you're a gorgeous girl. I mean, you're an amazing looking girl. You're smart as a whip. Well, I mean, you must be, I was going to say beating people off, but, you know.
You know what?
You must be just avoiding the attentions of young men and older men all over the planet.
Somewhere between the two. Possibilities.
Middle-aged men we're talking about.
No. Somewhere between beating them off and avoiding them.
Okay, good. Well, that could be the title of your seventh book, couldn't it, darling? Somewhere between beating off and avoidance.
That's brilliant. You're brilliant.
Anna David.
So what happened then is then I got sober.
Yeah.
And you were, yeah, thank God. And you were very much around in those early days.
Yeah.
There was a night before I was sober when you and I had dinner at Dan Tana's with my friend Liz. Don't you dare say I remember this, because I know you don't.
No, I remember us at Dan Tana's. And Gabriel,
and
my dearest friend.
And then I got sober and you were around and I so appreciated that, you know, and Jonesy and
Steve is a pillar of sobriety, which is... You see, that's he represents to me what the new cool is in a nutshell, because he is the smartest man I know. This is a man who couldn't read or write till he got sober.
I didn't know that.
That's correct.
But he's not a big talker, Jonesy.
You don't have to be. You don't have to say a lot to be smart. Mm-hmm. That's one thing I've learned. You know, I call it high cool. You know, obviously messing with the idea of the Japanese couplets that are so clean and clear and zen and precise. And he is clean, clear, and zen, and precise. And I will ramble on for hours. It takes him a couple of sentences. And I rely on his intellectualism. Because if you think about it, you can be intelligent by reading Martin Amis.
He's my favorite author. That's weird that you would name him.
Really. And one of mine. Or you can be aware of the human condition.
Right.
Right. So that's what he is. He is a street... And savant is almost derisive, and it's not the right word. But somebody who's blessed with the brilliance of Steve Jones, who is, which is at such variance with any concept of punk.
Mm-hmm.
But as he's fond of saying, anything I do is punk. Whatever I do is punk. So there's a certain brilliant logic to that, you know,
right.
That you don't have to be confined by... killing your girlfriend in a hotel in New York.
Can I tell you something crazy?
Yeah.
Jonesy and I were hanging out a little bit when I lived in New York by virtue of the fact, not hanging out like that.
Yeah.
I was dating this Frenchman who was on this soccer league fabulous Europeans.
Yeah.
And I went to go see this guy play soccer and I couldn't find him because I'm nearsighted and they all looked the same. And then I was like, is that Steve Jones? Like, that would be so, what would Steve Jones be doing here? Anyway, he was there for a few weeks.
Oh, yeah.
And we started
hanging out. What year was that?
It was, I want to say, 4 years ago.
4 years ago, yeah.
And he had never been to the Chelsea Hotel.
Yeah.
So well, I walked him over there.
Oh, that's pretty historic.
I know. And took all these pictures of him right in front of the Chelsea Hotel for the first time.
Well, he's a beautiful man, you know, and he's my favorite guitar player. And I listen to his music every day of my life because I work out every morning of my life and I have an iPod thingy that just plays, you know, that hardcore rock and roll that I love so much. You know, yeah. Iggy and the Dolls and all of that, that whole school of music. And you know, and I got to be in Checkered Pass with the guy. But the point is that you know, anybody that tries to characterize sobriety or rock and roll or anything
yeah.
is out of their minds.
Right.
And dealing in archetypes that are so dull and boring, which right. is why I turned away from acting to a degree and got into broadcasting. And, you know, and I narrated 200 motels at the Disney Hall a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
LA Philharmonic, yeah. And I'm working with the Glendale Philharmonic on another project, which is about it brings tears to my eyes. I didn't even think about it, but it's this Polish guy who rescued a lot of Jews from the Holocaust in Poland. And it's an amazing story. And this friend of mine, Sharon Farber, who has written a string concerto based on this guy's experiences, and I narrate it, which is not easy because I'm from Chuck Berry land, you know, and now I'm with an orchestra. I mean, a few weeks ago, I was in the Disney Hall with Esa-Pekka Salonen conducting the LA Philharmonic, you know, reciting the Frank Zappa's words while 160 musicians played and 30 voice choir. And it was I've been in some big bands. You know,
yeah, that's...
I haven't been in, you know. And the point being is you can do anything you want and retain the enthusiasm and energy and freshness and joy of rock and roll and not be in, you know, high heels and lipstick. You know?
Right.
I mean, especially when Lou Reed passed, I think that was a big slap in the face for a lot of people to wake up and realize, you know, because we only realize when these people are gone.
Right.
The ones
that... But people realized with Lou Reed. I mean, do you think it was surprising because, you know, he had a liver transplant, right?
That I think the surprise was is that Bowie lives forever. Right. We're at a point in our culture where all of our heroes, in terms of rock and roll, and in acting, like I saw Redford movie this weekend in his mid-70s.
I heard that's amazing.
And he is... magnificent. He's on screen for the whole movie. Nobody else in it. And he plays this guy who's, you know, he's a patrician man, an elegant man. His boat is sinking and he deals with it. He's already dead.
Right.
You know, inside. And now he's going to die on the outside. It's interesting. Fantastic performance. Point being, older heroes are now dying.
Right.
So we have to deal with that.
Right.
And when Bowie goes, God rest his soul, I hope he lives to 1,000. But he won't. And when he does go, I think culturally it'll be an enormous shift. You know, when Mick or Keith go, you know, I mean, right. this is huge. You know, because it's not the 27-year-olds going. You know, this is people that
they
we've lived with.
Too.
They still go, but we can mythologize them.
Right.
But
right,
when
right.
they're 70 and right. they're like, and they look it.
Right.
And you look it. When I look it, you don't look anything
you
like it.
You don't age, so well, I don't know.
It's
you
the blood of
don't.
Virgins and wheatgrass. But I, you know, it just fascinates me to when he passed. I dedicated one of my shows to him and researched it very deeply. What Patti Smith thought about him, her being for me, you know, I mean, an incredibly important person in
right.
the arts. Just Kids was a masterpiece. Her music is brilliant. Her poetry is brilliant. Just what she represents. You know, I know, and I went to this lecture that she gave to 10,000 youngins in Central Park in the summer. And the first thing she said, Anna, when she came out on that stage, sat on that stage, she looked just like Patti Smith. Long hair, lank hair, you know, and a white T-shirt and everything's too big and there's no jewelry and, you know, maybe a couple of subtle bracelets. And the first thing, and she's Patti Smith, people go, oh, my God, it's Patti Smith. She comes out and she goes, use dental floss. It's the first thing she says to those kids.
It's good advice.
Unbelievable advice. Point being is she's Patti Smith.
Yeah.
The priestess of punk, the empress of New York. You know, lady heroin, you know, the queen of rock and roll. And she comes out and tells those kids to dental, you know. So what is cool?
Right.
Can you define it? You know, anything you do is cool if you know who you are. We're in the business of self-expression. You got to find out who that self is before you can express it.
Right.
Once you do, you're cool.
Yeah, yeah. I think that that's true. I think that you know, I think as an adolescent or whatever, I was so unhappy and so unwilling to admit I was unhappy that I really thought cool and all of that mattered so much. I didn't realize it was a made up idea. Yeah. I just thought that if, you know, I think I was determined to get somewhere, you know, to be accepted, something that I thought,
well, it's identity. Everything's about identity. But you can latch on to the wrong archetype. You know, James Dean, they say, culturally, gave a voice to that peculiar and awkward time in your life where you're not a child,
right,
and you're not an adult. So he gave a
voice. That's the worst time.
Yeah, that's the worst and most difficult time. Yeah. And everything depends on those few years. That's it.
I think everything depends on 0 to 7, which totally fucked.
I wouldn't argue with that.
Most people I know.
I wouldn't argue with that.
And that you spend 8 to 90 trying to undo whatever damage was done between 0 and 7. And I think that early 20s, or for me, all of my 20s, it was just a bad time. And I get it. And I, you know, I don't wish I could go back there. I think it's like you're so powerless. You're so clueless in a way that you can never fully understand.
Yeah. That's why my life has been peculiar, because from 16 to those ages that you're discussing, I was into So Would Love, and I was a prince in London. You know, I did that movie with Sidney Poitier when I was 16, and we were...
Which movie? Why?
To So Would Love.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
In 1966. And we were, you know, royalty then, you know, and then I got into rock and roll, and then I, you know.
But you were royalty, literally royalty.
Yes,
anyway.
I was in that, yes.
Okay, so briefly. Yeah. So, okay, Baron and Baroness were your parents.
My father was a Marquis.
A Marquis.
And this is a French title recognized by, you know, the idiots in power in England at the time, because it is idiotic. I never ever used it as any tool for publicity or to get laid or any of those things.
You didn't need it.
No.
Had you needed it, though?
Cheekbones will do it. But but at school, these ridiculous schools that I went
to. Did you go to Eton?
I went to a very similar school, mm-hmm. which was this masturbatory, you know, pseudo-spiritual, abusive, hypocritical, immoral, absurd.
Was it religious?
Education.
Were there priests that
everything,
were abusing?
Everything is religious in those days, especially in that strata of society, you know, up and Downton Abbey, as I call it. Mm. I was in those schools for 8 years, from 8 to 16. And because my mother was a paranoid schizophrenic, she was in an institution, and my father was in jail for fraud and embezzlement. And I'd only gone to these schools because my father put me down for them when I was one. It's that system where the child goes through the education that his father did, and his father. My school was 800 years old. That's older than the United States of America. Okay. It's a school I went to. Some gothic building in Yorkshire, you know, where you expect Heathcliff to come running out of the bathroom.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Your father had embezzled money because the wealth of the family was gone.
Well,
Did he lose it?
Yeah.
Okay. So he got a great inheritance that he squandered?
He got a huge inheritance. And when I was born into a family of great wealth and privilege. And by the time I hit 8 years old, it was all gone. Because he was a gambler, right. And he was a womanizer, a drug addict. And my mother was his, I think, sixth wife. I don't know too much about him because I didn't spend much time with them. At the time that I did, and I was thinking about this yesterday, and it was kind of fascinating, was, you know, I walk on my toes, and I walk very precisely, and I move very precisely.
Right.
And quietly.
You think you got that from him?
No, I got it from avoiding her.
Oh, wow. Tiptoeing.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And because when you're dealing with that kind of mental illness, you don't know what's going to happen. So I could completely, fully realize the idea of danger.
Yeah.
But it didn't frighten me because I found ways to deal. And this is the peculiar
thing.
That's
the thing about children.
Good thing about children.
Because it may torture us later, but at the time, we don't know any
different.
Well,
you adapt. And yes, it might torture us later, and yes, it's been torturous. The more you strip away the artifice in your life, the more you get in touch with those moments.
Yeah.
So those moments, therefore, become more potent in your dreams, and your relationships.
And your reality.
And your reality changes. The more clearer you get, the more you're horrified by these circumstances, and the harder the work becomes.
Yes and no. I mean, I believe that you know, the horror is there. You know, if you suffer trauma, the horror is there whether you are dealing with it or not. And if you're dealing with it, at least you are moving through it.
Yeah.
And dealing with it is actually a lot more pleasant than acting out in an effort to avoid
Absolutely correct. With no question. I mean, avoiding anything is absurd.
Yeah.
I mean, what are you going to avoid? You've got to be there for it right here, right now. I mean, it's not a new thing. These last few years has been very much culturally, you know, focusing on the existential moment.
Right.
The now, the
right.
power
terrible,
of now, Eckhart
Tolle,
yeah, all of that. And that's a very difficult concept to grasp, you know. It's
Well, as soon as you're thinking about, am I in the now, you're
well,
not in the,
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? You know, it's like acting. It's like, all right, okay, I'm a killer, okay. So does that mean I have to go out and kill people to find out how to play a killer? You know, I mean, people really, you know, ask you these questions, you know, how do you do that? And it's called pretending.
Right.
There's no, I mean, you know, when I see Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln, and I hadn't seen it when it came out, I watched it the other day, and this was a staggering performance. But you can, you know, just because they have to call him Mr. Lincoln off and on set doesn't mean that he thinks that way.
Right.
You can't go and have a latte dressed as Abraham Lincoln. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's just not going to work. Mr. Lincoln, your omelet is ready. You know, it's...
I was in a movie. Can I just interject?
Yes.
Because I never get to say this sentence ever again. I was in a movie called, oh God, I should at least remember this. I Love Your Work. It was Adam Goldberg, you know?
Oh, I love Adam Goldberg. He's so talented.
So funny.
Oh yeah.
He wrote and directed this movie, and I knew him. And so he put me in it as a paparazzi like reporter on the red carpet.
What a stretch.
And I had to, it is a stretch from where I am now, but that was what I did for a while.
Yeah, I remember.
You and yours, I remembers, which like...
No, I remember. I remember full well that you did all of that gossip stuff. I've even seen stuff of you on telly, you know, on the YouTube things of doing red carpet and doing...
Okay.
Or being on Inside Edition. I'm not lying. I remember everything.
You're stalking
me is what the truth is.
Well,
you know
not.
What? I've got a new idea for a reality show. Celebrity stalkers.
Oh.
Me and Don Johnson went to see John Mayer at the Hollywood Bowl, which in itself is a fabulous sentence.
Yes.
But we went back to see him with Katie, and John Mayer would not leave Don Johnson alone.
Oh, he was just so thrilled.
Yeah, he grabbed Don's phone and put his number in there.
Hilarious.
And for the next few days, he texted him constantly.
Right.
And he called me, Mike, this guy, I can't get rid of this guy. You know, he's like, you know, and it was a celebrity, and we came up with the idea of celebrity stalking.
That's
Thank
pretty
you very
funny.
Much. Anybody listening that wants to produce this, please go contact me, and Anna will make millions.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be really easy to get cooperation for that. Everyone's going to be signing releases left and right. But my point about this is, so I had six lines in. I was in a movie.
Were you terrified?
Thank you for letting me say that again. Yeah. Oh, I was totally terrified. And I learned the most important thing about acting, which is bring your Uggs. I didn't understand. Yeah. You know, I was wearing high heels.
How much horrible time there is.
Yeah, I didn't get. And like the real actresses, they were in their Uggs. Yes, and I'm in those high heels and my feet.
No.
Oh, my God.
No.
So I had six lines in this movie.
And it was awful. You were saying them so much.
No.
But you got.
No.
What?
I mean, I was a natural.
Yes,
I'm not. But for whatever reason, it went fine. But I had to rehearse with Giovanni Ribisi and Franca Potente right before.
Great at both of them. Wonderful actors.
I know. I mean, for my debut, great colleagues to have. And I
Scientologists.
Not both of them.
Giovanni.
Yeah. We didn't discuss it. But we did go into his trailer and run lines. And he was very weird and not, you know, he didn't seem... He was just like, yeah, that's fine. And then I told Adam, you know, I was like, oh, my God, Giovanni hates me. Something super annoying that a director would not want to deal with. And he's like, oh, he's a method actor. He's just in character.
Yeah.
He's not going to be nice.
Yeah. Well, the whole notion of method acting to me is fantastic in whatever process you have. I was very fortunate to interview Bruce Dern. And I asked him, as I ask all actors, Eddie Begley, all of them, I say, well, how do you do it? And his response was fantastic. He's a guy whose body of work is really unparalleled, you know, and the most extraordinary performances. He's going to win.
I heard he's got something out now.
I've seen it. Nebraska. It's not out yet. It's out any minute.
Yeah.
Nebraska. In black and white movie directed by Alexander Payne, who did Sideways and The Descendants. Incredible director and an amazing movie and an incredible performance. And I got to speak to him. And I said, well, how do you do it? And he said, well, you have to be publicly private. I said, what? He said you have to be publicly private. You have to be able to be intimate with 120 people reading the sports page around you. You know, you have to be able to be there and block everything out. It's like that illusory moment when you're in a romance and you two are dancing and everybody dissolves into nothing.
I've read about that.
Yeah. That's cute.
Go on.
And but he made that analogy that to be able to dismiss everything that's going, which I'm pretty good at that. I can let go of everything around me and just vibe in on what's happening.
Yeah, you have that energy.
Yeah, I can do it.
Yeah.
I mean, and I always say, and I've said it for years, and many people have said it, the biggest stars I've ever known, the people that, and by that I mean the most successful and the most grounded.
Yeah.
Not the biggest star, egoistic stars, but the biggest stars that shone brighter than the sun are the ones that make you feel you're the only person alive in the world at that moment. And that's what it is. And if you really look at it, Warren Beatty's like that. The people I've met.
You mean you, and you wouldn't know until you're with them in person.
That's right. You wouldn't know. You don't know. Streisand was like that.
What's
Clint Eastwood was like that. You know, Sidney Poitier was like that.
Yeah.
You're the only one person that exists.
That's such a great quality. My mother has that quality, and I'm not saying that you're... Yeah. I am one of the great stars of our time. I'm saying that my mother has that quality, and I inherit it to a degree. I think there's no greater compliment that people can give me than, you know, you make me feel so special, like I'm the only one you see.
Yeah.
But there's also, you know, with that intensity, that comes at a price, you know?
Yeah. What price is that?
Well, I think that sometimes that can be an obsessiveness. I think, you know what I mean?
To what? People please?
No. I think if you're making somebody, let's say you're at a crowded dinner and you're making one person feel like the most important person there. I guess you're talking about something different. You're talking about one-on-one. But it's sort of can mean, you know, I think I used to have a big thing about sort of deciding you're better than me and I want your approval so much. I guess that is people pleasing. And so I'm so focused on you.
I'll give you everything
you.
I've got.
Yeah, I'm so focused on you because you matter to me so much.
Yeah, but you've changed in that case. If that's what you were, that's not what you are now. I think that genuine interest in people makes a great interviewer.
True.
Or makes a great anything.
You know?
I mean, if you are genuinely interested. If I say to the checkout girl, those earrings are so perfect on you, she's going to believe me.
Right.
Because I'm telling the truth.
Right.
I mean, I learned very early on that there's a frame here. And it just moves. That's it. It shifts here and there.
You are very good at that, about noticing and treating every single person you interact with like they are important.
And they are.
Yeah.
It's not, I didn't assume this stance.
Right. It's just.
I did maybe for a little bit, which is what you're talking about, the one that, I want your approval, so I want to.
Right.
And that certainly was what I wanted. Audiences, you please. And then. And this is going to sound so pompous, but at Live Aid, you know.
Live Aid.
And there I was. And I looked out there, and there's 100,000 people there, and 2 billion people watching. And I realized, I'm in the trailer, and I'm thinking, what is this? Dylan is like in his trailer, and all the rock stars are like, the inner sanctum around this trailer because he was the god there.
Right.
You know? It's so interesting to see, you know, Jagger and whoever, you know, just, oh my God, Dylan's in there, Jesus.
Right.
You know, and Madonna's scribbling words she might forget on her hand and the humanity of it.
Right.
The humanity of superstardom. And I saw it. I saw it clear as a bell. I thought, I'm going to go out there. I'm petrified. I've been with the span 10 days.
Right.
And they had Robert Palmer, and they kicked him out or whatever. He left. He didn't want to play in front of 20,000 topless girls, and they thought of me, strangely enough. So I went and got the gig. But, like, literally 10 days, I'm now in front of the biggest audience in history.
Right.
So I had to get it together.
Right.
And pull it together. And what happened was I just knew that it was a relationship between me and them.
Yeah.
It wasn't the sermonizing, being adored, pedestalized idiot up there in tight trousers, you know.
Trousers were tight.
I wasn't wearing trousers. I was wearing a miniskirt at the time. But
were you really?
No. But the thing is that, you know, but yeah, the look is everything.
Yeah.
But what is above everything is the connection that you feel.
You're
and
right.
It's a relationship. I mean, mean, all the great mystics have said this. Krishnamurti, so I would go and see him every summer in Ojai, you know, and he was 90. Krishnamurti is an Irish guy. No, Krishnamurti is an Indian guru, philosopher, who came over to London in the, I guess, the teens, maybe the 20s, early 20s, and lived a very long life. Ended up in Ojai, which is in Southern California for your listeners who are around the world.
International.
And it's an orange grove, and he settled there in the 30s and began a foundation, a school, and he would speak. And he would say, you know, this is not, I'm not here to tell you what is real and what is happening and what is the truth. I'm here to have a conversation with you, and together we are to, of course, nobody else spoke, but that's the way you felt. Mm-hmm. So if people can do that, listen to him.
Now, I have been horribly negligent because we are supposed to be talking about addiction and recovery, and I believe that I have not asked one thing about that.
Well, I mean, everything is about addiction.
It's so true. It's so true.
Everything I'm saying has been learned because I'm clear.
So at what age did you – so what were you doing drug-wise?
Oh, drug-wise, I was a cocaine Jack Daniels rock and roll guy. And what were called Quaaludes then, which was, you know, you take them, you fall in love with the coffee table, they were that kind of, you know, and you have sex with a coffee table, which is not easy.
I missed those.
Yeah, thank God. Well, having sex with furniture is not your thing, Anna, obviously. And nor mine. Although there was one of Chaise Longue in Cleveland that was particularly attractive. Yeah. But I – it was the legs –
a sucker for a good pair of legs.
I am a sucker for a good pair of legs, yeah. But drugs, coke.
And cocaine, you were coke, just snorting it.
Yeah, I would skin pop it, you know, and I would do all sorts of things. Heroin, going down, if you'll pardon the expression.
Mm-hmm. Not your thing.
No. No. I liked hysteria.
Yeah.
And, you know, and full throttle. That's what I liked.
Yeah,
I was, you know, like in as a school, as an athlete, I liked 100-yard dash. I didn't like 6-mile runs. You had to be way too, you know, together to do a 6-mile run. You know,
like
my stamina came in bursts.
Right,
you know,
right,
and
right.
That's what I like, bursts. And then I would temper the madness with, you know, Jack Daniels and what we'll call Quaaludes then, you know. Actually, they were called mandrakes in England when I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash. Because in the middle 60s, when I got out of school, these horrible hypocritical boarding schools, and now I'm in London and I'm in drama school, all these cute girls and boys, and the Blues and the Faces and the Stones and the Animals and Jimi Hendrix, and, you know, forget about it. You know, the streets are paved with velvet. You know, so... And we would eat hash because it was that Guy de Maupassant, you know, lotus eater, you know, cool.
But it's disgusting tasting.
Well, Jack Daniels is disgusting.
But the consistency. It's, you know, so you would eat it, just not baked into foods, but just...
No. I'd buy a block of it, and I would chew it. I would just bite it and eat it because it would get in your bloodstream.
Yeah.
It took a while. Here's the problem. It took a while to come onto hashish. So you'd eat it, you know, and I can see that you know. You'd eat it, and then 40 minutes later, you'd be going,
no, it didn't
this
work.
Is pathetic.
So let me
clearly,
eat
some more. I've got to eat it all. But yeah. So then you eat it all, and then you're gone for 3 weeks.
I ate a space cake in Amsterdam, and the exact same thing happened, except that I lost a day. My friend and I got up in the morning, and we said, I can't believe it. We were so, so messed up. It's so great
that we didn't miss our
flight, and we had missed a day. Yeah. Gone.
Yeah, well, I missed a few years.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it was fun. I've got the photographs to prove it.
But
somebody else does. Or Miss Pamela does. But hashish, fantastic. That was the first thing. But that was trippy. But then rock and roll, and then stamina. Then I needed to play every night. And it's intensely boring, as you describe. Uggs. In my case, I only wore silver high-heeled shoes.
So you needed something to take the pain
rock
away.
So a lot of it was the boredom of it, you know, is why I got into it. And coke was the de rigueur drug. Plus, I was terribly impressionable and wanted to emulate one's heroes. And my heroes were all, you know, the usual list. You know, Keith, Lord Byron, you know.
Lord Byron was doing opium.
Well, same, hash, you know, it's an opiate. You know, I mean, it's that dreamy thing. But then it became, as you said... fun for a while, not fun for a while. And then the not fun for a while was 81. And that's when I quit.
Okay, wait. So you were sober for Live Aid because that was 85, right?
Oh, yeah.
Look at my math and my recollection skills.
Amazing with figures.
So 81, and you have been sober since. Mm-hmm. And was it challenging to put it all down? Not everybody was doing that back then.
Nobody was doing it. I was a leper, a pariah.
Is that true?
Avoided. Oh, yeah. I mean, you see, this is why it was so good for me, because I realized how foolish it was to spend 23 hours in a row talking about when you were five and repeating oneself. So,
right.
Of which everybody did, except me. I was on a private plane with one of the richest, most successful, youngest musicians ever.
Who is that?
They were called Duran Duran.
Right, right, right.
And
this was after you were sober.
This is, yeah, 2 or 3 years later. And I had constant reminders of what I was doing was probably the right thing. You know, I would get up, I would run, you know, because I run with the bodyguards, and I would go to the local store and buy everything I could possibly buy clothes-wise, mm-hmm. and jewelry, and come back. And by the time I came back after living 2 or 3 lives, you know, they were all coming too.
Right, right.
I think the drummer was handed a bill at the end of that tour, and I was handed $1 million, so you work it out.
So, but were you tempted while you were touring with them?
Never.
Never.
The reverse.
Right.
Whatever
right.
the opposite of tempted is.
Yeah.
Repelled, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it wasn't that savage. I loved those boys.
Yeah.
And actually, you know.
Jewel John's sober now.
Well, I mean, you know, I guess one can say that. You know, it's in his book.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and it's a brilliant book. I mean, John Taylor's book?
Yeah, I want
to read that. Oh, my God. In the Pleasure Groove, incredibly well written. And he's just a brilliant guy. He's just a fantastic guy. And Andy, and it was great. I mean, you know, and the drummer's passed away, God bless him, for the very reasons we're describing.
Right.
You know, and I got it. Never was I, I honestly can say I've never, ever been tempted by going backwards.
Wow.
But then again, I'm not a going backwards sort of a person.
Right, right, right.
You know, I never really revisit the past. The only reason that I revisit the past in the internet and in the social media is because they want to see those pictures.
Right.
Because nobody looked like that. And the ones that, you know, I mean, there is none of that rock and roll Sodom. You know, I put out a live album yesterday, came out yesterday. We got 95,000 hits on Google yesterday.
Amazing.
As I think I told you before, I'm very proud of it. I can't even believe it. I am staggered by it. And I think the reason for it is because who the hell puts out live albums?
Right.
And who plays rock and roll music?
Right.
Very few people. You know, and everything is lip-synced, which I despise, and everything's auto-tuned, which I despise, and everything's technologically shifted and shaped into some, you know, perfect product. And that's the opposite of what I do. I mean, when I was a kid, I was more interested in hearing the mic stand fall over on a record. That's
right,
what I wanted, was those mistakes, where all the beauty is, and all the... That's why I love animals, because, you know, there's no predictability there. You know,
and that's why I love podcasts, because it is a medium where it's not that people could call it unprofessional. It's the humanity. That's why I'm so obsessed with them. That's why I listen to them in my car, because I feel like I'm actually sitting and listening to the person being interviewed, as opposed to this PR concocted BS that we've been fed for so many decades.
Well, it's not the event. That's the thing that you, I know that you have learned, and I've learned, is that if somebody comes on as is promoting something, I'll cut it short.
Right.
And if they, because it's not about the event, it's about the person who is experiencing the event, and why and how, and how did you get to that point to enable you to experience this event. And the event is irrelevant.
I know, but I've been on both sides of it, because, we live in this world where the people, you know, especially when you're with a publisher, they're like, go sell that freaking book. We're certainly not selling it. So you better go sell
that. Well, the book
sell
thing, in terms of you being so prolific and having, you know, six books to your credit. That's an incredible discipline, and it cannot go unnoticed. The thing that I would say is publish it yourself without question, because there is no money in books, and not even for Pete Townsend. So
Yeah.
You know, people are just not reading books. They're just not reading them, you know, and yet the irony, of course, is that every bass player in every group that ever existed has written a book.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not being judgmental here. I'm simply describing a phenomena of the, how many rock and roll stars can write their books, and the trajectory of which is working class.
Yeah.
Made some money, bought mom a house, got addicted to drugs, died twice, came alive twice, and now works with rescue animals. And that's the book. And they're all the same.
Unless you're Keith Richards, in which case you skip the last part.
Well, you skip the last part, and you're incredibly mean about the man that you were with and have and still are for 50 years, and you said he had a small penis. Not cool.
Right.
Keith is the coolest man alive. Up to a point.
Right.
But we can't have idols.
Right.
You know, idols are ridiculous.
Right. I agree. But I was going to say something about, books. I mean, it's kind of boring tangent, but I think there is a problem with people not reading. I don't know. Part of me thinks Kindles, Amazon, people are actually reading more. That the problem is less that and more that the publishing industry is broken in a way.
No. I agree. I'm saying physical books don't exist and are not selling. You can get it online. A lot of people are buried in books on their Kindle, and I think that's great. And they've got the little, flashlight in their forehead, and they read at night, and it's beautiful. if they do read books, it's almost like some Denzel Washington an apocalyptic movie with the book and the candle and books must live and kind of movie, with the bad guy would be Alan Rickman.
You'd be the bad guy.
Probably. If I was still in that game, but I really am not in that game.
All.
Well, I just did California Solo with Robert Carlyle. That's pretty great. And he's that just so came out. He's great. I found a ridiculous actor and we had a great time. And I did this movie called Me with Jeff Levy directed it. And it's with Molly Ringwald, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Gina Gershon. And it's all those 80s girls and me. And that was really fun. It was improvised. So that was interesting to me. The discipline of going with the LA Philharmonic was interesting. The discipline that I'm about to do with the Glendale Philharmonic, doing this story about this hero who rescued all these people from the Holocaust, and I do my radio show, and I put my music out, but I'm no longer going to hit my marks and kill people on telly. Mm. I just can't do it anymore. I just read it, or it's some clown rock and roll guy, or it's some Jeremy Irons businessman in a pinstripe suit and an embezzlement charge hanging over his head.
You were so sexy on Melrose Place.
Well, I had the great advantage, of working with Heather Lear, who's the greatest girl in the world. And also a rock and roll girl. And it was, and doing that show at that time was fun.
Right.
Because it was a cultural zeitgeisty show.
Right.
And I knew, I remember I went to Australia in the middle of it to go see a girl I was dating at the time. It's a funny story. She was an actress. She was doing a series in Australia and I was on Melrose Place and I went over to Australia to see her. And my season of Melrose Place had just started to be aired in Australia. I'd been there 1 hour. I went to the mall to get toothpaste and I was swarmed by Aussies. The problem was, of course, that I went to visit my girlfriend who was now in love with the teenage star of the series that she was filming down
Not
there.
Convenient.
His name was Heath Ledger.
What's crazy is I remember you telling me this. She was the sister of an actor.
Uh-huh.
God, I have a good memory. You told me this the night at Dantana's.
Yeah.
And I remember you telling me that because it was before his stardom had peaked. You were like, he's going to be the biggest star in America. And I said, no, that guy with the long hair and 10 Things I Hate About You are so wrong. And you said, no, I know. And this is why I know.
Yeah, because she's an incredible girl. And he was 17. And I met him. And I fell in love with him like everybody else did.
Right.
I remember distinctly the limo pulled up. They're on location outside of Sydney. Glorious location, fantastic. I can't wait to see her. And I see this gorgeous guy in brown leather pants and no shirt, bareback on a horse riding across the field.
Did you say,
and I go, God, I felt it was like an arrow in my heart because I just knew that the aesthetic would be irresistible to her.
Right.
And I was right. And I literally got on a plane the next morning. you know.
But at least the Aussies, like, you know, Michael DeBar chased you out in excitement.
That was good. That was good. That was really good.
To assuage the ego.
But that's when I think of Melrose Place, I think of that. It's funnily enough, I don't think. But it was great doing it, you know, and spelling and it, that whole world is.
It doesn't fulfill you.
No.
Not that you would turn it down if they came
Well, it would depend. I would turn it down. Turn down things every week. If it
really?
Wasn't, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, sure.
So this was a conscious decision. I don't want to act. I
want
to.
Well, I don't want to put myself through the time wasted.
Right.
Because it's like you so
with
accurately observed. It's Ugg time. And I don't possess a pair of Uggs.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I wouldn't dream.
I couldn't see you in
one. No. They don't have heels.
No.
Look at these boots. I wish you'd view
it. I wish I owned those boots.
They're just
staggering. They're
really cool. Yeah. And they, you know, they're Beetle boots. And like everything, they have pink on the inside, but
your yellow socks.
Yeah, well, you know, what are you going to do? But no, that was fun. Melrose, are you kidding? Great zeitgeist.
Yeah,
part of the culture.
Yeah,
but then again, I've been part of the culture.
Yeah,
on
you hit
levels.
A lot of cultural points.
Yeah.
You manage that.
Yeah.
What? And then let's talk about Obsession, the song you wrote, which is really a great song about addiction and alcoholism.
Yes,
I believe.
It is exactly correct. I'm very glad that you know that. You've done your research. It was written.
I only had to hear it to know that.
You did.
Obsession, you're my.
Who do you want me to be to make you sleep with me? You are obsession. You're my. It's so good. It goes. I will have you. Yes, I will have you. I will find a way, and I will have you like a butterfly, a wild butterfly. I will collect you and capture you.
Collect you.
Collect you and capture. You know what it is? I got the image from a movie called The Collector, which starred Terrence Stamp and Samantha Egger in the 60s, about a guy, little guy played by the gorgeous Terry Stamp, who wins the lottery and buys a van and sees this girl and stalks this girl and kidnaps a girl and takes her to a house he's bought with the lottery money and sets it all up. She's an artist and sets it all with paints and canvases and her clothes and in the dungeons of this place. And played by Samantha Egger, who I met at a screening a couple of weeks ago.
I don't know who that is.
She's a British actress, Julie Christie-esque girl, freckles, red hair, gorgeous. So that image was in my head of a guy who was so obsessed with something. But with me, it was coke.
Yeah. So you wrote that song about cocaine?
Yeah. And everybody thinks it's a love song.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then Animotion came out with a terrific version, you know, not what I would have done with it, but fabulous and very.
And there was a video, right? Was there a video?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Them in sort of, you know, like the. I'm now miming shoulder pads and headbands just for you guys, so you're in on the thing.
Did you know that song was going to be.
I knew it was catchy.
Yeah.
You never know if they're going to catch
on. You never know if anything. Yeah.
You know if they're good and it work for you.
Yeah.
But I figure that that's the only criteria that there is, you know. Is
yeah.
it work for you or not? If it works for you, like I said to somebody today, somebody, you know, on Facebook will say, Michael, how come that this happened? And you know, doesn't like criticism affect you? And what about when people really love you? I mean, how do you deal with all of that? And I always say, they're both the same. You can't trust either of them because if you allow people to critique you, then you're going to stop doing what you're doing, you know, because it's going to hurt you. And if you think it's that you're brilliant and it's fantastic, then that is going to take away the edge of it all and the need to do it.
Which happens to so many successful people.
I think success, as they say, the biggest cliche in the world, is harder to handle than the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah, always have always have success just to step away and be striving towards it. I mean, that's the best place to be.
I think that's true. There's another way of doing it and just accept that you're going to be successful.
Right.
Because to be in the consciousness of success is to be successful.
Right, that's true.
If I'm happy for you and your seventh book, then my first book will be a hit.
Right.
And that's what one has to get
so
into.
So hard. And I don't know if that is the way I was raised, if that's my, you know, alcoholic personality, but jealousy.
What is
crippled.
An alcoholic personality?
To me, self-obsession coupled with self-hatred, and that drives you to have to drink and do drugs to excess. Also, trauma, I think, can bring about that sort of way of thinking so that it's impossible to live, so you either have to kill yourself or you have to find a way to stop those thoughts. And you find alcohol and drugs, and then when it works, like real, real, real well. And then it stops working and it turns on you and it makes it worse than it ever was, even in the beginning. And that's when you're really at the jumping off point. Mm. And that's why to me, 12-step programs give you, you know, with some other things, a way to live and actually deal with that way of thinking.
There's a degrees of powerlessness is what I discovered. Is, you know, when you view yourself as being worthless, you know, it and I learned this strangely enough as an actor playing killers and stuff, which I've done a lot.
Yeah.
The reason that I could do it post sobriety was I knew what it was like to hate yourself so much that you it doesn't matter.
Yeah. That life just that you would just
kill and be killed and this was sobriety taught me how to act.
Right. Sobriety taught me how to do everything.
Yeah.
Taught me how to
The thing about it is if you nail it down, then you can remember Tender is the Night by F. Scott Fitzgerald. You can remember it. You can feel it. If you're loaded and you read it, you can't.
No.
You know, and that's pretty telling, isn't it?
I would say so. Yeah. I mean, also, you know, some people are able to work on drugs. I don't know. I couldn't. I mean,
well, you can for a while.
My lifespan of being able to work on drugs was very, very short.
Yeah, me too. I only was addicted, really severely addicted, for 3 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, when I was out of control, when it owned me, yeah. I mean, I owned it for, you know. I mean, I didn't start getting loaded till like 71, which probably to you guys sounds prehistoric, but for me, it's not. It was like, I was addicted for five.
And you got sober in 81, you said?
I got sober in 81, and I started in 71, and it was only the last 3 or 4 years that I was insane.
Those last
insane.
3 or 4 years, yeah. And were you locked up alone?
No, I was never alone.
You were never alone?
No, I've never been alone.
In your life?
Not really.
Really?
Not really,
You never did that crazy, you know, doing cocaine
isolated
and looking out the window?
No. There was always somebody there to get me loaded, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't drive.
Right.
A vehicle until I was 120, until I was like 40, you know, and I'm now 65.
Which is amazing.
Yeah. And I didn't drive, and I couldn't get from A to B. So, there was always somebody.
There had to be somebody there.
There was always somebody going my way, Anna, yes.
I'm not surprised by that. So your show, the Michael DeBar show,
yeah,
can be seen where?
Can be seen TRadioV.
TRadioV.com.
TRadioV, one word. And you can see and hear it. It's on a number of FM stations, WSDI in Chicago. It's on KongMonster.net here in L.A. It's on in Tahoe in New York. I'm joining the Sirius family in January.
Congratulations.
And
you have amazing guests on there. Tell me who some of the guests have been.
Judd Nelson, Ed Begley Jr., Bruce Dern, Rosanna Arquette, Bob Forrest.
Yeah, I know him.
You should. And amazing character.
And Steve Jones went on.
Steve's been on there. Robert Patrick. Coming up, I've had Elvira on for Halloween, who was just absolutely magnificent woman who you would adore because she created herself.
Right, right.
And it created this incredibly, indelibly etched in American culture, Elvira, which I love, that whole Pee Wee. You know, people that create characters through which they express themselves is fantastic. And I have Julian Lennon next week, and I'm interviewing Don Johnson the following week. I'm doing Belinda Carlisle after that, and then we're doing next week I'm doing Ione Skye.
Yeah.
And her husband Ben Lee.
Right, right.
Because they're very spiritual, very interesting couple.
Right.
And it all sounds very celebrity oriented because the nature of what I'm doing sort of demands that in order to get people to listen and look at and but
that's not the content I've listened.
No, I don't talk about stardom or anything like that. I talk about what they really feel. In Judd's case, since that's the show you saw, how interesting is Judd Nelson?
A lot more interesting than I ever expected him to be.
Exactly, and that's my job.
Yeah,
is to bring what is interesting. So therefore, if one can do it with somebody who you do not expect to be that interesting. The issue here is that, as you've discovered, I know, and I see it in your eyes, everybody has a story to tell.
Yeah.
It's so corny, but it's true. Everybody's been through something.
Yeah.
You know, their uncle has done this to them, and they did this, and they have fantasies of this, and they really like to collect, dead butterflies and make, dresses out of it.
Right.
Who knows, man, But everybody's got some.
Yeah, some people are better at expressing it than others.
But you know what? That is true. But at the same time, I sort of like hearing people reach epiphanies. It's an amazing thing. It's almost like I can feel it, and I feel like I'm steering a giant, galleon in the Armada in the 18th century, and I've got this great wheel and a sort of Jack Sparrow, but not as camp.
Right.
And I'm steering this thing, and you can feel them, just the boat, and then they get it and they go, and they hit a wave and it's all perfect. And I don't care who they are, In fact, the very ones that you think are going to be articulate and free are the ones that choke.
Yeah.
And go, you get a bunch of, syllables that don't make any sense.
Well, I found also that if somebody's uncomfortable, this is part of my codependence, I start to get really uncomfortable.
Do you really?
Yes.
I do not.
That's good. I can't see you uncomfortable under any circumstances.
I don't get
though.
Uncomfortable.
Yeah.
No.
It's not an experience
in the
had.
Middle of the night, I get, sometimes I'm uncomfortable,
If your neck is sort of...
Not physically. Physically, I'm a yogi. But it's the, as we were discussing, the dreams come.
Yeah.
Of the past, of the childhood, really? And the thing, and the tiptoeing, and the thin ice, and the mother, and the thing, and the schools. Because it was Dickensian at best. It actually made Dickens look like, Sesame Street, my upbringing.
What do you think that has to do with your addiction?
Well, where do you turn?
Yeah, exactly.
There's no parent figure. There's no author. I didn't respect anyone.
Right.
I went to these schools and saw them abuse boys and was abused by them.
How were you abused?
By physically, sexually, by...
Really?
By, of course.
By men.
By men. Indeed, by men. And I've been abused by every sex, darling, it's just one of those great burdens that
I've had
to
Michael
carry.
DeBar.
Yes, it's one of the great... Yes.
Every day a woman abuses you,
abuses
sure.
me all the time in parking lots. But I, so I could see the absurdity of authority.
Yeah.
And how I had to have no faith in it. That's why I'm very interested in what's happening right now, because all of our institutions have let us down. There is no institution that I can think of...
Right.
Whether it be a sports hero, whether it be a musician, whether it be a politician, an elected official, whatever it is, who has not been compromised by the greed and corruption, exactly as Russell Brand described. Of course, I don't agree with the voting thing that he came up with. I certainly feel that it's push comes to shove time. And that's why I have this off the grid theory. You can't disappear and expect things to get better.
No.
Just because you're growing your own Brussels sprouts doesn't mean you're metaphysically free.
Right.
Freedom on that level is getting stuck into the community and working with, being of service to the community.
We are so at our done point, and I could talk to you for about another
month.
Year.
Oh,
look how pessimistic you are.
Only a month.
I'm offended. Yeah.
Well, I'm used to doing series that only last 3 weeks, and then they're canceled.
Well, this was such a good opportunity to catch
Thank
up
you,
with
Hannah.
You, darling, because it has been way too long.
Yeah.
It has been, and I would love to come see you perform live.
Oh, yeah.
I
would love you to come and see one of the radio shows.
I'd love it.
You meet those people.
Let's meet those people.
And maybe the next time you see Anna is going to be on T-Radio V.
T-Radio V. You heard
That's
it here
right.
first.
Yeah.
Exclusive. Okay, darling, so wonderful. Thank you.
God bless you all out there.